So the book I'm going to be reading from is called 88 Names. It's my latest novel. It was published last year, about a week after the lockdown started, which is, of course, the perfect time to publish a book. The trade paperback came out this month. The book is set about 20 years in the future, at a time when virtual reality has sort of achieved its platonic ideal. And the main character, John Chu, is what is known as a Sherpa, which is basically a paid guide to virtual reality online role-playing games. And the big game at the time is what's called Call to Wizardry, which you can think of as a full-blown virtual reality version of World of Warcraft. And basically, the way this works, if you wanted to play this game or some other online role-playing game, but you don't have hundreds of hours to invest in creating a character and learning how to play, you can pay John Chu a fee, and he will provide you with a ready-made high-level character with cool weapons and armor and a team of skilled playmates, and basically cater a night's adventure for you in this game. And this is his business. And one of the difficulties is that the use of Sherpas, like buying gold, is considered a form of cheating. So it's a violation of the terms of service. So one of the risks you take working as a Sherpa or hiring Sherpas is that there's these in-game police called the EULA cops, the enforcers of the end user license agreement, who may occasionally burst in on you and ban your accounts for violating the terms of service. And but that's just part of what you do. If you're working as a Sherpa, you just build that into your accounting. And so John Chu has multiple accounts, 88 names. So if one gets banned, he can just pick up where he took off and start with a new one. So in the opening of the novel, he leads a guy named Brad Strong, who is a Wall Street day trader, pays him a bunch of money to take him on an adventure. And sure enough, the adventure gets interrupted by the EULA police, who bust them and kick them out. And the chapter that I'm going to be reading from occurs right after that. John and some of his coworkers are meeting up with Brad Strong afterwards in this virtual cafe, talking about what just happened. And Brad is not happy with them. The thing you need to know that most of everything you're going to hear here is taking place in virtual reality. So, and this section opens with a quote from Lady Ada's Lexicon, which is a fictional dictionary that I quote from throughout the novel. So, avatar, the audiovisual manifestation of a person or software agent in a virtual environment. Avatars can resemble any animate or inanimate object that their host computer is capable of rendering. They can all also manifest differently to different observers simultaneously. In a three-way virtual conference, Alice might appear to Bob as a photorealistic rendering of herself, while Charlie sees and hears her as a cartoon character, a talking horse, or the ghost of Neville Chamberlain. This ability to project multiple aspects, known as faceting, allows for all manner of interesting exploits and shenanigans. I'm not fucking paying you. Jolene and I have reconvened with Brad at the game lobby, a virtual lounge that is popular as a pre- and post-run hangout spot. The lobby has a cyberpunk chrome and neon aesthetic. There's a bar with a Jumbotron TV that's always tuned to your favorite channel, a laser-lit dance floor that switches over to karaoke three times a week, an arcade where you can play emulations of old coin-op video games, and everywhere, interactive screens you can use to find teammates for Call to Wizardry and a dozen other popular MMORPGs. The three of us stand around a table near the edge of the dance floor. I've invoked a cone of silence so we don't have to shout over the music. We've all switched to our default avatars. Brad no longer resembles a racist Gilbert and Sullivan character, but he still doesn't strike me as someone I'd want to know in real life. I didn't attend a normal high school, so I was spared the ritual humiliation that a lot of nerdy kids go through, but I've seen enough Glee reruns to peg Brad as the kind of guy who spent his formative years stuffing nerds into lockers. Jolene is a tall, fit black woman in her early 50s. Her avatar resembles her Facebook photos, though like most people, she's made a few edits, smoothing away some blemishes on her skin and erasing the gap between her front teeth. And of course there's her hair, which on Facebook is natural but short, a conservative do that comports with her day job as an IT specialist for a Colorado Springs law firm. Her avatar sports a complex weave whose interlocking braids hang down to the small of her back. It's a style that in real life would cost hundreds of dollars in hair extensions alone and require God knows how many hours of upkeep, but here in Fantasyland, it's free, and you don't have to worry about strangers touching it. If you subscribe to People magazine, you might recognize my avatar from the spread in the March 8 issue, John Chu, Sherpa to the Stars. My legal surname is Conaway, but I go by Chu out of respect for my mother, who raised me, and also to cut down on awkward questions like, how come you have an Irish name when you're Asian? My avatar has fewer acne scars than I do, but the main difference between us is what I call the mom and pop switch. It's a piece of code created by a friend of mine, Jamone Campbell, who's also biracial. Scott's English on his father's side and Yoruba on his mother's. Jamone's folks were divorced but shared custody, and growing up he noticed he got treated differently depending on which parent he was with. One day as an experiment, he took some public domain morphing software and created an avatar extension that allowed him to emphasize one side or the other of his ethnic heritage, in effect presenting as a blacker or whiter version of himself. The results surprised him. He expected it to affect people's behavior, he said, but wasn't prepared for how strong the effect was. I paid Jamone $100 to write a version of the code for my avatar. I use it as a business tool. The historical connection between Chinese hackers and gold farming has given rise to a stereotype that ethnic Chinese are natural-born Sherpas, just as we are all biologically predisposed to score high on the SATs, so for initial meetings with clients, I like to put on my mom jeans. When dealing with customer complaints, on the other hand, I find that you can never be too Caucasian. At the moment, I have the dad setting cranked up to 11. Even at that extreme, Brad may not consciously notice, but Jolene does. She B-channels me. From Brad's point of view, she's standing motionless with her hands folded on the table in front of her, but I see her leaning close, eyes going wide in astonishment. Oh my God, she says. White? Whiter? Whitest? I ignore her. Outwardly, I'm aping my father, but inside my head, I'm in 100% mom mode, running a psych profile on Brad and trying to work out a strategy that will get him to cough up the rest of our fee. I could threaten to blackball him on the Sherpa forum, but that would probably only make him laugh, while appealing to his sense of fairness might provoke the part of him that likes stuffing nerds into lockers. Really, anything that can be interpreted as weakness is best avoided. I decide my only hope is to throw him off balance and try to redirect his anger. Did you hear me? I said, I'm not fucking paying you. You bought gold, I say. The words bring him up short. What? Ivar's hammer would have run you at least 25,000 gold pieces on the auction house. Your samurai was broke when I gave him to you, and you couldn't have gotten more than a few hundred for your katana, so you must have bought gold. So? So I'm guessing you didn't buy it from the in-game currency shop. After years of trying unsuccessfully to bar gold farmers from Call to Wizardry, Tempest had decided to undercut their business by allowing players to buy gold legally from the company store. The price fluctuates, just as it would on a real gold exchange, but is kept low enough that black market gold selling is no longer profitable, with one exception. I bought the gold from a guy advertising on the same forum where I found you, Brad says. I nod knowingly. Here's the thing. The only way to make decent money selling gold in Call to Wizardry anymore is by stealing it. These guys crack players' accounts, liquidate their characters' possessions, and then sell the gold to people looking for bargains. Brad shrugs. Players careless enough to get their accounts hacked, the shrug says, are not his problem. Except they are. Everything that happens in the game world is recorded, I say. As soon as those hacked accounts get reported, Tempest can track exactly where the gold went. They can't punish the thieves because the money you pay them is outside the system, but they can punish you. Brad shrugs again, but with less conviction. You don't know it was because of me, he says. They busted you too. Because we were with you. When Tempest traced the gold and saw you were in a party, they must have decided to hang back and eavesdrop a while. That's how they knew we were Sherpas. Look, I understand you're upset, but we're not the ones who fucked you over. You want to be mad? Be mad at Tempest. Be mad at the ripoff artist who sold you that gold. Brad looks away and appears to think it over. When he turns back to me, he is nodding, and his carefully composed expression suggests he's decided to be reasonable. It's then I know for certain that we're screwed. You're right, it's not your fault, Brad says. But I'm still not fucking paying you. Another shrug. It's like what you were saying about the company. I can't punish the guys who really deserve it, so I guess I'll have to settle for taking it out on you. Jolene breaks her silence. What is wrong with you? Why would you want to be like... Brad cuts her off. Who asked you to butt in, Beyonce? You think I give two shits what you... Dead to me, I say. Brad disappears. His avatar still occupies the same coordinates in cyberspace, but I can no longer see it or hear it, and he can no longer see or hear me. Jolene goes on staring across the table, listening to, and, I assume, recording whatever Brad is saying to her. Another half minute elapses before she says, "Dead to me," and sighs. "Griefnet?" I ask her. "Nah," she says. "If he dropped the N-word, I'd post it to Griefnet. But I can't be too mad about Beyonce, even if he meant it as a slur. So I guess we better break the bad news, huh?" Anya and Ray are waiting for us in the lobby arcade. Anya's avatar looks like Anya herself did before her accident. A pretty, petite teenager with a gymnast physique. Anya's family, the Kirchners, are a clan of German Argentines who live in Paraná. Anya was on her way to the Summer Olympic trials in Buenos Aires when the van taking her to the airport got sideswiped by a bus. She was left partially paralyzed, and an experimental stem cell treatment meant to repair the damage instead made things worse, rendering her unable to breathe on her own. The machine that keeps her alive has a thought-controlled VR rig that reads and interprets the electrical impulses in her cerebrum. Anya's online 24/7, which combined with her eagerness to please and her relative indifference to money makes her the perfect employee, a fact I try not to take too much advantage of. Jolene tells me I need to try harder. Ray Nelson presents as a 30-something white guy with a medium build, brown eyes, and short black hair. He has no social media presence, not under that name at least, so I don't know if he's really a white guy, but if forced to guess, I'd say he probably is. People masquerading as another race or gender tend to gravitate towards stereotypes. Ray's avatar isn't celebrity beautiful or Aryan chic, nor does it suggest an inbred hillbilly. He looks, by white guy standards, unremarkably ordinary, and who would want to pretend to be that? Jolene has some interesting thoughts on the matter. Not long after she became a Sherpa Incorporated regular, she asked me what I knew about Ray. I told her he was the best healer I'd ever worked with. "What about offline?" she said. "What's he do when he's not playing?" "I don't know," I replied. "He doesn't really talk about himself." Jolene, not satisfied with that, used her IT skills to sniff out Ray's IP address. She looked it up and found it was one of a block of IP addresses assigned to an internet provider in Southeast California. The provider's coverage area included a region of the Mojave Desert that is said to be popular with people who are legally forbidden to live near children. "You think Ray is a pedophile because of his IP address?" I said when Jolene told me about this. "I don't know what he is," she said, "but my gut tells me he's hiding something. You don't get that vibe?" "Not from him," I said, "but I'm starting to wonder what you haven't told me." One thing I do know about Ray is that the Sherpa gig isn't a part-time job for him, it's his main source of income. Which is a concern, because good healers are hard to come by, and if he can't make rent working for Sherpa Incorporated, he won't hesitate to join another crew. I already came close to losing him once before. "He stiffed us," Ray says, not even waiting for me to deliver the news. "We got stiffed, right?" "The guy's an asshole," I say. "Look, it happens. Just bad luck, that's..." "Bad luck?" Ray's avatar's cheeks stay pale, but I can tell that he's red-faced with anger. "And what about that thing last week, or the two the week before that?" "We have been going through a rough patch lately. Tonight is the third time in a month the EULA cops have busted us during a run. On the previous two occasions, our customers did pay us, but they were unhappy and left us 1- and 2-star ratings on the Sherpa forum. Last week's incident was different. The run itself went off without a hitch, with the client, who went by the screen name Ollie Oxenfree, opting to add a third dungeon at overtime rates. The trouble started afterwards when Ollie failed to meet us at the game lobby. My instant messages and emails inquiring about payment all bounced, and when I tried to log back into Call to Wizardry, the account I'd used for the run had been suspended. Besides stiffing us, Ollie had ratted us out to Tempest. "It's not bad luck," Ray says. "It's Darla." "You don't know that," sounding uncomfortably like Brad as I say this. "She's getting even with you, like she promised she would. And she's making the rest of us pay, too. Come on, Ray, don't be..." "I'm sorry, John. I can't afford to keep doing this. What if I give you my share of tonight's upfront money?" Ray makes a face. "The guy only paid a quarter in advance, right? So even with your share, that's only half of what I'm owed. And you can have my share too," Anya pipes up. Jolene interjects. "Oh no, you can't. You keep your money, honey." "It's not just the money," Ray says, staying focused on me. "I don't have a million spare accounts like you do. You know how long it takes to level up a new cleric?" "You want a replacement for the one you lost tonight," I say? "I'll give you one of mine. Two. I'll give you two." "Two clerics," Ray says. This is insanely generous, and he knows it. "Max level?" "One of them is. The other's in the high hundreds, like 170 or 175. "I could finish leveling that one up for you," Anya offers. "It won't take long." Jolene opens her mouth to say something, then thinks better of it. But I know I'll be hearing from her about this later. "Two clerics," says Ray, still mulling it over. "And your share of tonight's upfront money?" I nod, trying not to think about my own unpaid bills. All right, Ray says. I'll stick around a while longer. But you need to go deal with Darla. Find her and kiss her ass, or whatever it's going to take to get her to lay off. I will, I promise. Don't worry about it. Darla has me blocked on social media, but if you go on her Facebook page, you'll find a profile pic of what looks like a young Chloe Grace Moretz in combat boots and paint-spattered camo, sitting cross-legged in the grass with a paintball rifle balanced across her knees. Her green eyes look out from under sweat-matted bangs, and she's got this wicked grin on her face like she knows something you don't and is wondering just how long it's going to take you to get a clue. According to her bio, she's Darla Jean Covington, Virginian by blood, Arizonan by birth, Oregonian by choice. A 22-year-old white, bi-curious, cisgender, middle-class, apolitical atheist omnivore who doesn't like being put into boxes. Ha ha, see what I did there? Occupation, shit stirrer and gamer girl. Relationship status, single. We met in Call to Wizardry in the Jurassic Swamp, where we'd gone to farm dinosaur hides and Archaeopteryx feathers. The game server we were on is used primarily by South Koreans, and it was 3 a.m. in Seoul, so we'd both been hoping to have the swamp to ourselves. After a cursory attempt at sharing, we started stealing each other's kills. When I bagged a rare T-Rex that Darla had her eye on, she challenged me to a duel, and despite her character being 4 levels below mine, she kicked my ass, twice. I offered her a job with Sherpa Incorporated on the spot. Considered purely as a player, she was a great hire. Her DPS skills were phenomenal, but she could also tank, and while she didn't really have the temperament for healing, in a pinch she could do that, too. In the area of customer relations, however, she left a lot to be desired. When clients were rude, Darla took it personally. When they made mistakes or were slow to understand the rules of a boss fight, she made fun of them. This latter tendency in particular bugged the shit out of me. As I kept pointing out to her, our business model was dependent on our clients being amateurs. If they could put in the time required to become great players, they wouldn't need to hire Sherpas. I know that, Darla said, but they're just so lame sometimes it makes me want to scream. When she wasn't alienating customers, Darla poked fun at her coworkers. Anya, the German South American, got a steady stream of fugitive Nazi jokes. I got cracks about lactose intolerance and requests to share my thoughts on Mickey Rooney's performance in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Getting under Ray's skin was harder since he revealed so little about himself, but Darla somehow deduced that he was Catholic, or at least sensitive to remarks about Catholics. She was still teasing out which heresies most offended him when he threatened to quit. I should have fired Darla then, but our relationship had gotten complicated, so instead I just read her the riot act. She laughed and told me I was cute when I was angry. I told her I wasn't kidding. She could knock it off or she could look for another Sherpa crew. Fine, she said. If Ray's going to be such a huge pussy about it, I'll leave him alone. Anya, too, I said, and the customers. All right, she said. And she did knock it off, mostly. I was relieved, though I also assumed that this was temporary, and that in a week or a month she'd start in again, and there would be another crisis where I'd have to choose between her and the business. I still believe that. It was doomed to end badly, one way or another. But the way it did end was this. I got a call from the CAA agent who represents Janet Margot. She was set to co-star with Jaden Smith in a film about a Sherpa crew who stage a bank heist in cyberspace, a sort of Snow Crash meets the Thomas Crown Affair. To research the role, Ms. Margot wanted to spend a couple of days hanging out with some real Sherpas. People magazine was also interested. If I agreed, they'd embed a reporter on one of the dungeon runs, get some video and some screenshots, and interview me about the business. I hadn't even said yes yet when I started worrying about Darla. What if she decided to razz Janet Margot about the lousy box office on that Citizen Kane remake she did last year? Or what if she decided to get edgy and say something racist to the People reporter? I could have tried talking to Darla to impress on her how potentially important this gig was for the future of the business. I could have admitted that I didn't trust her, her recent good behavior notwithstanding. But I was afraid of how she might react, so I took a more cautious, which is to say cowardly, approach. I scheduled Janet Margot for a weekend when I knew Darla would be offline, FaceTiming with her family at a reunion in Virginia. I brought in Jolene, who'd subbed for Darla a couple times before, and only told Ray and Anya what was up at the last minute. And even then, I was cagey about it. I think Ray understood that I'd cut Darla out deliberately, but Anya didn't get it. She thought it was just bad luck that Darla couldn't be with us. The gig went extremely well. Janet Margot was thrilled, and the reporter said she'd be devoting a full page to our interview. I told myself that I'd made the right call and that even Darla would come to agree with that after she'd had some time to cool off. But I wasn't in a hurry to test that theory. The day Darla was due back from the reunion, I went to the Jurassic Swamp again. Call to Wizardry's most recent software patch had introduced a new subspecies of Velociraptor whose claws could be used to make magic necklaces. I switched off my instant messages and settled in to farm a few hundred of them. Darla came online and went to the game lobby to look for me. She ran into Anya, who, not knowing any better, spilled the beans about what we'd been up to in Darla's absence. Back in the swamp, I got into another territorial pissing match, this time with a couple of low-level griefers. I picked a fight and killed them until they got bored and went away. I was still plagued for player-versus-player combat when Darla found me. She'd logged in as a 200th level Death Lord, so the first sign that she was coming was when the ferns at the edge of the clearing I was in shriveled up and turned black. She burst through the dead foliage, wielding a flaming two-handed sword the size of a telephone pole. "Hey, Darla, let's talk," I said. She decapitated me. I came back from the graveyard and she was desecrating my corpse. I knew if I resurrected, she'd just kill me again, so instead I hovered there, disembodied, saying, "Come on, Darla, let's talk." She logged out. I did too. I went to the game lobby and waited. It was karaoke night, and a group of senior citizens were competing to see who could do the most grating rendition of Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On. As penance, I decided not to invoke a cone of silence. But that was self-indulgent bullshit. One of my mother's most often repeated pieces of wisdom is that there's a difference between being unhappy with the consequences of your actions and being sorry. I was unhappy that Darla was pissed off, but I didn't regret what I'd done. If anything, her reaction confirmed for me that I'd made the right decision. Not being sorry, I knew it would be wrong to apologize. I could explain why I'd done what I'd done, I could try to make it up to her, but to say sorry when I wasn't would only add insult to injury. "Do not apologize," I counseled myself as I waited. "Do not apologize." Then I saw her, standing over by the bar. She saw me too, had seen me first, no doubt, but pretended to ignore me. I walked up to her. "Darla," I said. She turned and threw a virtual martini in my face. This is less effective than throwing a real drink. It passed right through me. Darla's words had more of an impact. "You lying, backstabbing piece of shit," she shouted. On stage, the latest bout of Titanic theme music had just ended, and the scattered applause hadn't yet begun. Darla's exclamation landed at full volume in the space between. Suddenly, it felt like everyone in the game lobby was staring at us. I spoke without thinking. "Darla, I'm sorry. I..." "Sorry?" Darla said. "You're not sorry. But you will be. Then, dead to me." That was 2.5 months ago. I spent the first week awaiting Darla's revenge, which I assumed would take the form of a post on the Sherpa forum. There were things she could have revealed about the nature of our relationship that would have been embarrassing and maybe bad for business. But time went by and no post appeared. Darla blocked me on social media, as I've said, but she didn't take her accounts private, so by logging in under a different name, I could look and see that she hadn't posted on Facebook or anywhere else, either. It was as if she'd left the internet entirely, though of course she was free to log in under a different name too. The People magazine article came out. The publicity had the effect that I'd hoped for and more. Sherpa Incorporated was suddenly very busy. I raised our standard fee and hired Jolene as a full-time replacement for Darla. We made good money at first. There were a few negative repercussions. Some of the other Sherpa outfits, jealous that Janet Margo hadn't picked them, started bad-mouthing us. Others complained that by inspiring John Chi wannabes, the article was creating too much competition, driving overall profits down. Gold-selling scams increased, and Tempest, unhappy with the expansion of the black market, began cracking down harder on EULA violations. All of the accounts we'd used for the Janet Margo job got banned. The price of fame, I figured. I had other accounts and could afford to get more. I settled into what I thought was the new normal and talked about expanding. But now our luck has changed again, and instead of building a larger crew, I'm struggling to hold the core group together. Karma or Darla? The main argument against the latter is that I just don't see Darla having the patience for an extended revenge scheme. Her idea of a long game is making sure you're listening with both ears before she unloads on you. But strong emotions can cause people to act very differently than they normally would. That's another of my mother's axioms. I keep thinking about the expression on Darla's face when she pronounced dead to me in the bar that night, which was the same expression she wore when she cut my head off in the swamp, as if she were wishing that the invocation of death were more than just a metaphor. I'm about to log out when I get an instant message, the words appearing in a pop-up box at the bottom of my visual field. "Are you available to meet now? Smith." Smith, no first name, no Mr. or Ms., just Smith, emailed me a week ago, claiming to be the personal assistant of a wealthy, famous person who wanted to hire a Sherpa for a special project. The job paid quite generously, Smith promised, but added that the client wished to remain anonymous. Would that be acceptable? Coming as it did on the heels of the Ali Oxenfree incident, this offer struck me as highly suspicious, but on the off chance it was for real, I wrote back. I said that I was fine with not knowing the identity of my employer, so long as they were willing to pay my full fee in advance. And by the way, what did quite generous mean in actual dollars? When I got no response, I assumed that whoever it was had given up the gag after having their bluff called. I'm available, I messaged back now. Where? Game Lobby Private Chat Room Number 24, Smith replies. Entry code 77G4M9. The door to the chat rooms is right outside the arcade. I knock and a peephole slides open. A robot bouncer jabbers at me in faux Star Wars droid language. Room 24, I tell it, and recite the code. The door opens and I step directly into a conference room where Smith and the client are waiting. They are gray people. This is a special type of anonymizing avatar, inspired by a bit of business from an old Ursula K. Le Guin novel. Users manifest as androgynous, racially nondescript humanoids with light gray skin. The avatar suite includes an audio filter that replaces your real voice with an accentless monotone, though unless you're also speaking through a translator, your word choice can still give information away. I see they have opted not to use the avatar's lack of affect toggle. The gray person on the right is smiling as I enter, and he or she regards me with an open and intense curiosity. The gray person on the left is more reserved, but in a way that suggests seriousness rather than an absence of emotion. Smith, I say? I am Smith, the serious one replies. He, I decide to think of him as he, because otherwise I'll think of him as Darla, indicates his companion. This is my boss, Mr. Jones. Hello, I'm John Chu. I nod. Jones doesn't nod back, just goes on staring at me, his smile starting to seem a little creepy now. I understand you're interested in hiring a Sherpa for some sort of project. Yes, Mr. Jones says. I wish to undertake a comprehensive survey of the world of Morpigs. Morpigs. MMORPGs. What kind of survey? Smith answers. Mr. Jones believes that the design philosophy of massive multiplayer online role-playing games may have applications beyond the realm of mere entertainment, applications that are relevant to his own profession. Which is? Not your concern. I have researched the subject of Morpigs, Mr. Jones says, read articles, watched videos, but I lack first-hand experience. I want you to help me rectify this. Okay, I say. Do you know which games you'd like to play? All of them. All? You know there are dozens of them, right? Hundreds if you count the legacy games. All of them, Mr. Jones says. I wish to experience the full potential of the medium. You can arrange this for me? I can, I say. I've got accounts on all the most popular MMORPGs, and I can get others, but it'll cost you. Money is no concern. It is to me, I think. What do you want to start? As soon as Smith is satisfied with the security arrangements, you understand I must maintain strict anonymity. Yeah, I got that. The logistics of that I leave to Smith, but I do have a question before we begin. Go ahead. It is about identity. He lowers his gaze and studies the backs of his avatar's hands. I can resemble anything I wish to in here, looking up again, and so can you. And so can anyone else. I nod, guessing where he's going with this. Yes, Mr. Jones says. So when you are guiding me through the world of Morpigs, how do I know that you are you and not one of my enemies? How do you know that I am me? I can't tell whether he's asking because he really wants to know or just wants to see if I do, but I've got this covered. It's a standard cryptographic protocol, I say. Here, let me show you. I pass my hand over the conference table between us, causing three objects to materialize there. A small blue box, a blue key, and a red key. I pick up the red key. This is my public encryption key, I say, offering it to Mr. Jones, who accepts it after exchanging a quick glance with Smith. Because it's public, I can give away a copy to anybody who wants one. The blue key is my private key, I continue, and I'm very careful not to let anyone else have that. Now, if I want to send you a message, I can put it in here. I lift the lid of the blue box. Inside is a business card, which I hold up so Mr. Jones can read the words pre-printed on it. It's me, John Chu. I put the card back in the box and close the lid. Now I lock it with my private key. I turn the key and the box turns red. And I send it to you. I slide the box across the table. If you've got my public key, you can open it. But so can anyone else, Mr. Jones says. Anyone with your public key can read the message. Unless the message is also encrypted with a code that only you have the key to. But that's not necessary in this case. In this case, the real message is the box itself. My public key will only open boxes that were locked with my private key. So if you get a box that you can open, you know it came from me. I see, Mr. Jones says. Clever, but also cumbersome. Anytime I wish to verify your identity, I ask for a box. It's just a metaphor. I nod at the table. The box disappears, and the key in Mr. Jones's hand transforms into a key fob, the kind you use to find your car in a crowded garage. Go ahead, I say, pointing to the little blue speaker pin that has appeared on my avatar's lapel. Try it. Mr. Jones stares at the key fob like he's never seen one before. Then he says, ah, in a way that makes me think Smith just B-channeled him. He aims the fob at me and pushes the button. It's me, the lapel pin says in my voice. John Chu. A new smile appears on Mr. Jones' face. He laughs like a little kid and presses the button again, and again. It's me, John Chu. It's me, John Chu. It's me, John Chu. A dozen times. Finally satisfied, he lowers the key fob and turns to Smith. This is the one I want, he says. And then he's gone, without so much as a goodbye glance. Thank you for explaining public key encryption to my boss, Smith says. You did a much better job than I would have. It's no problem. I consider telling him that I created this demonstration for Janet Margot, but divulging even that small a detail about a former client relationship might come across as indiscreet. Instead, I say, I want you and your boss to feel totally comfortable. It is good that this is your attitude, Smith says, because your encryption protocol is inadequate to our security needs. Inadequate how? Are you worried about the integrity of my computer? I am worried about that also, but I was referring to the encryption itself. I generate the keys with a really good privacy app. It's solid. No known vulnerabilities. No publicized vulnerabilities, Smith replies. You're saying someone's found a hole in RGP? I'm saying my boss has powerful enemies with extraordinary capabilities. Enemies like who? The NSA? Their identity is not your concern. But I'm going to require root privileges on your computer. I will be modifying the operating system and installing additional software that you are not to remove or tamper with. You understand why that's impossible, right? I try to say this lightly, but it's hard to keep the disappointment out of my voice. For all of its weirdness, I've been starting to hope this job offer might be genuine. I understand why you would be reluctant to grant root access to a stranger, but you will do it. No, I won't, Darla. I am not your darling, Smith says. Now listen carefully, John Chu. In addition to granting me the access I require, you will clear your schedule of all other personal and business commitments. You will make yourself available on 15 minutes' notice, any time of the day or night. You will show my boss the world of MMORPGs and answer his questions. You will explain things in a way that he can understand. You will do all of this tirelessly and without complaint, and you will tell no one else what you are up to. In exchange, you will receive a weekly salary of $100,000 for as long as Mr. Jones chooses to employ you. $100,000 a week, I say. And is that U.S. dollars or Monopoly money? You can have it in whatever currency you like, Smith says. As per your email, I am prepared to wire the first week's payment right now to the bank account of your choice. The money will be available for immediate withdrawal. You can spend it, transfer it to another account, or do whatever else you require to convince yourself it is real. In 72 hours, I will contact you again, and you will either agree to my terms or refund the money in full. Will that be satisfactory? 5 minutes later, I stumble out of the chat room and head for the bar. You can order drinks from the cyborg bartender, but since this is virtual reality, you have to provide your own intoxication. Tonight, that won't be a problem. I'm feeling plenty stupefied. PayPal has just sent me confirmation of a deposit of $100,000. A part of me is wondering how Darla could have faked this, while another part is trying to figure out if it's too late to avoid reporting the income to the IRS. If I'd believed for a moment I might actually get the money, I'd have handled it differently. I'm almost at the bar when a Chinese woman catches my eye. The avatar looks a lot like my Aunt Penny. It's not her, but the woman smiles as if she expects me to recognize her. I'm sorry, I say. Do I know you? That's a good question, John, she says. Her accent is British, with just a hint of Cantonese. Let's find out. Do you have another of those red key fobs? The question takes a moment to process. Then, feeling as though I've downed a bucket of virtual martinis, I hold out my hand and conjure another copy of my public encryption key. She doesn't take it. It's not for me, she says. It's for you. She points the little blue speaker pin on her blouse. Try it. I aim the red key fob, press the button. It's me, the blue pin says, in my voice. John Chu. There you go, says the woman. I suppose we must be twins. Who are you? I'm you, John. She laughs. Or maybe I'm someone with extraordinary capabilities. What do you want? I want you to take the job. You'll really be working for me, of course. I'll pay you twice what Smith's offering you. $200,000 a week? And what else are you going to want for that? One thing at a time. For now, just tell Smith yes. All the humor goes out of her expression, and she gives me a look that is terrifying in its seriousness. Don't disappoint me, John. You won't like what happens if you do that. At all. She smiles again, winks. Then she's gone. So, that is the basic idea. So, he ends up taking this gig, and but of course he's curious, and what he will eventually come to suspect is that Mr. Jones is actually the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, who has nefarious reasons for wanting to learn more about VR entertainment. So that's the basic setup of the story, and the first two thirds of the novel take place entirely in VR, except for a few flashbacks. So it's this constant guessing game of who am I really dealing with? How well can I even trust my coworkers and my friends? And then the last third of the novel, we come out into the real world and the masks come off and you get to find out who's who. But so that's the basic idea.